Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Right. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the west, with the speed of light and a hearty, "Hi-oh, Silver!" the Lone Ranger rides again. Oops, sorry, wrong podcast script. Hello, it's Espigan Journal Club in your thoughts and in your ears. Thanks for tuning in to learn what Dr. Jake Mann thinks are the raisins in the loaf for this month. Jake's choices for today are from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by Hoskins et al., writing from Indianapolis, that's in the USA state of Indiana. Pediatric Endoscopic Mucosal Resection, a 10-year single-center experience. To follow by Kuletska, I think, from Cork and Galway in Ireland, Malaga in Spain, London, and Utrecht, and published in Nature Communications, combining mucosal microbiome and host multiomics data shows prognostic potential in pediatric ulcerative colitis. So we have a sort of an amuse-bouche from JPGN, and then a very full plate indeed from Cork and Galway. As I understand it, the message from Hoskins et al., out in USA flyover country during a period of 10 years at a tertiary care pediatric referral hospital, 20 mucosal or submucosal lesions were treated by submucosal resection using cold or hot snare, banding, and underwater techniques. The supplemental materials for the publication include video recordings of resections using these techniques. Fibrosis in one lesion precluded complete resection by a submucosal approach and made surgical resection necessary. The procedures otherwise were technically successful and were tolerated well. The authors conclude their report by urging colleagues not to shy away from submucosal resection in treating polyps in pediatric patients. Well, Jake, 20 over 10 years, two every year. How are you doing at keeping your hand in at pediatric submucosal polyp resection?
Well, I'm not a pediatric submucosal polyp resector, if that's a term for an individual. But there are other people at the institution in Birmingham who do it. I, off the top of my head, wouldn't know how many patients exactly they do a year. I certainly must be a few a year, but not a huge number. And that the number of individuals in this paper was one of the things that stood out. Because as you identify, if you're only doing two a year, then it is quite hard to train individuals in it who aren't already trained.
And for those 20, they brought in one of the big boys from the big people's hospital on the same campus, didn't they?
I mean, that's quite common for the less frequently done procedures, and then have a sort of a pediatric person as well.
So here are these people, the Hoskins et al., are holding the flag high, flag or torch, whichever you like, and saying, we all should be doing more of this. How the heck are you going to get the numbers to become competent? How are you going to train? It's not as if they had resuscianis out there with polyps studying their artificial bowels.
Well, I mean, what I don't know is this is my lack of knowledge about Indiana and other U.S. institutions is relatively how bigger catchment area Indiana serves, and whether other even larger pediatric or gastroenterology referral centers would have a higher caseload, and perhaps that's the point they're making. I think the general point is extremely valid, and my first thought on reading this is what other alternative is there? You really are all these people going to have an open surgical resection that would, or laparoscopic, that would seem completely overkill for some of these lesions. But I guess that's what the inference is, the alternative if centers were unable to offer this as a service.
So why'd you pick this for us?
Well, I guess partly to make the point that the authors are making, that this is a critical service that I think should be offered to patients. And I think we're lucky that we are able to offer this in Birmingham for most of the cases that would fit suitable criteria. And I hadn't even realized that it was a thing that it may not be offered in some places. I just thought it was completely standard of care. So as a recurrent theme of our chats is me mostly highlighting my own ignorance with various papers that I didn't realize were a gap in my knowledge until I found that they were. So that's probably the main reason. And then this, yeah, the other thing was the pictures are really cool.
The pictures are indeed cool, I have to say that. I think that's what is possibly being ignored here is the mechanisms for paying for such procedures. If we were in Germany, for example, then you wouldn't want to be sending patients outside your own Bundesstadt to be taken care of by a different Krankenkasse. And certainly in the United States, you don't want to send patients elsewhere. That's a procedure, man, and procedures are highly billable. So that in the United States, where you have a, quote, pediatric specialty medical center, every place that you've got a McDonald's, then there really may be a dearth of trained personnel. In the UK, somebody, pediatric gastroenterologists working outside Birmingham, will be referring their patients to the center where submucosal resection is practiced frequently, or so it seems to me.
Yeah, exactly that must be the part of the reason why this, and again, part of my my blindsidedness of why this is even a thing. I certainly would encourage listeners to go and have a look at the videos and the pictures, and then have a read about the techniques. So obviously, the quality of the instruments and the kit they have is looks really good to me. Not that I'm able to do it myself, but it looks really impressive. And I think it's also nice to see that that kind of multimedia type article is available.
And well, it's flashy as all get out. We have cool, as you said. We have to give them that.
Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, I think the main kind of points coming out of this, from my thing, were more around structure and training. And for example, I don't think that, well, I'm pretty sure I know that there's, to be trained in endoscopic mucosal resection is not a core competency of training in endoscopy as a pediatric gastroenterologist in the UK. It would be something you would have to learn as a
You'd have to go to a big people's hospital, and you'd have to do an apprenticeship.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well. Yeah. Good luck in getting that out of your program director. who's going to cover your clinics, Jake?
The eternal question.
Okay. Well, let's turn now to what is a very substantial main course indeed. Let me just bring it up on my. I tried to abstract this and. Whoa, this was hard going, Jake, hard going. I don't want to discourage people who are listening at home, in the car, wherever, from seeking out the article, but whew. At any rate, not all children with ulcerative colitis fully respond to standard therapies. And our European colleagues asked, might analysis of the enterobiome, of the mucosal response to the enterobiome, by which I mean, and they meant the transcriptome, and of epigenetic modifications, indicate which children will not initially respond, thereby permitting early deployment of second-line treatment. They found that indeed lower microbial diversity with depletion of bacteria characterized as butyrate producers and mucin degraders correlated with a greater risk of relapsing after initial response to treatment. And so did the barbarism of oralization, that is colonization of the distal bowel by oral flora, the initial presence of Veillonella dispar in particular seemed to mark a propensity for ulcerative colitis to relapse. And similarly, Veillonella parvula was found disproportionately often in patients whose ulcerative colitis had relapsed because they sampled before and after and during. The effects of these bacteria on enterocytes in culture and in mice were studied. Those effects included pro-inflammatory responses that usual treatment for ulcerative colitis did not ablate. Finally, differences not only in transcriptome but also in epigenetic modification were found to be correlated with clinical course and with composition of the enterobiome. What's the bottom line there? Well, maybe analyses such as those that the authors conducted could be used to identify children whose ulcerative colitis is likely to be difficult successfully to treat. And the authors state that their work is novel in having predictive value. Jake, did I get it right?
Pretty much. What a lovely summary. Thank you very much.
You're just doing that so that you're just doing that to make me purr, scritch me behind the ears and all that. No, really. What is the take home message for the people out there listening other than sample everything and sequence it?
Well, that's one strategy to do science. I think the take home message is that if you want to do a really good microbiome study, it is not trivial. It is not as simple as we've got some poo from these patients, let's sequence the bacteria and see what we find. To get from there to a story is really, really hard. And these authors have taken a condition that is very clearly related to abnormal bowel movements and changes in stool, and therefore you would assume it's not new that there is difference in the microbiome in IBD.
Mm-hmm. So, but that's IBD and you and me, rather than IBD classes of IBD. Have I got that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So exactly. So the fact that there's a difference in the microbiome of patients with IBD compared to healthy controls is not surprising and not a particularly interesting question. They've tried to answer a clinically relevant question, but therefore a much harder question, and predicting relapse versus maintaining a remission. And I think the big picture would be for anyone who is thinking about doing a study like this, then just to sort of see the level of work that has been required to actually conclude that one bacteria or a series of bacteria are implicated pathogenically. And you're right, they've measured lots of things and sequenced lots of things. And my kind of follow-on point from that is that it is extremely difficult to truly integrate multi-omic data. And by that, I mean, particularly if you look at their last couple of figures, they have measured transcriptomic effects, they've measured microbiome, and they've measured epigenetic modifications. And each of them were used to have a relative predictive value. But that's each of those analyses individually. And then they combined them all in a multivariate model. But what is very difficult to do is to truly integrate the data, as in to find a straightforward link from the microbiome with this bacteria causes this transcriptional change, and that is seen to cause this exact epigenetic change. And their data didn't marry up like that, which is no problem, but it is another kind of pointer to say that if you're going to write a grant application, for example, and say, well, we're going to sequence everything and we'll do metabolomics and we'll do microbiome and then we'll shove it all together into a pot and then it will come out with a beautiful causal mechanism, then that is also extremely difficult.
Mm. Well, what they didn't mention is what can be done at the beginning of treatment, at initial diagnosis, may be to shift the enterobiome. Of course, I'm thinking about bowel sterilization and fecal transplantation.
That would be a really cool addition to the study. I think the other sort of things you could do would be, for example, in their mouse model, if they were to, they tried giving this bacteria to IL-10 knockout mice, which are a model of inflammatory bowel disease. Mutations in IL-10 can cause monogenic IBD, so it has a relevance to humans. But for example, you could imagine a whole series of more finessed mouse experiments where they're either blocking, treating with antibiotics, pre-treating with fecal microbiota transplantation, or co-treating to give further evidence of, in a living setting, of how this could be manipulated. And then, yeah, the then next difficult thing to do would be to move it into humans and see how can you modulate the abundance of these bacterias, and does that actually change the rates of remission and relapse? That's the final clinical translation, isn't it?
Well, it is, and yet we also have the question of which is chicken and which is egg. What sets particular kids up for, excuse again, oralization? Where do you get hold of, where do you get a situation in which Violanella species take over and the gut goes crazy?
Yeah, and I do wonder whether it is something to do with the actual mucosal inflammation, and that traps those particular bacteria or allows them to maybe maintain close to the mucosa, because they didn't do sequencing of stool. They did sequencing of mucosal biopsies for the bacteria. So perhaps it has something to do with the fact that a different type of IBD inflammation, which is more likely to relapse, holds on to that form of bacteria, or there is some surface adhesion molecule that makes it have a higher propensity to bind to those type of enterocytes that are also more affected. So you're right, they haven't demonstrated conclusively a directional causality in humans. However, their murine data would suggest that there is a causal effect there, because if it was totally associative, you wouldn't expect the addition of this bacteria to increase the metrics of inflammation.
Though you have to have a weak point. In those mice, it's interleukin 10 deficiency, and in humans, it's God knows what. That then sets you up for a Violanella incursion, and you've got riots in the streets.
Yes, or worse. But I think that the take home message would be that if you're going to do a study like this, or even just the first out in your setting about and thinking, oh, this is an interesting condition, I want to understand the difference in the microbiome, for example, looking at, you know, pick your favorite liver disease, let's say autoimmune hepatitis, for example, and what makes people respond versus non-responders to initial therapy? Is there a microbiome-related thing? Well, this is an evidence of a much more common condition, and it is really hard to get a clear answer.
What are we going to do about the people whose... Well, I'm sorry, I started a sentence without knowing how it was going to come out, and as usual, I got my tongue tangled in my teeth there. Jake, you're not the only one who's exposed as incompetent by these podcasts, let me tell you. Let's start with the question of how you pick the patients that have ulcerative colitis, and whether or not these findings are potentially to be extrapolated to persons with indeterminate inflammatory bowel disease or with Crohn's disease.
The generalizability is clearly very important. And in this case, they were, in general, about the typical age you'd see. So early teens years as a median.
They excluded the very young ones that might very well have monogenetic disease. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, so they excluded those, and there was a reasonable gender split. Now, this is purely in ulcerative colitis. So I think that particularly as we've talked about them having mucosal biopsies, it would be hard to immediately generalize it to Crohn's disease or IBDU. So they've picked their niche and have gone for that. And I think that that is a strength of the paper. But then, as you say, when we're interpreting it, we shouldn't then suddenly generalize and say, well, this is the case for all patients with IBD.
Jake, it's lovely that you're taking us through this. And I thank you for having put it on the agenda, both my agenda and our listeners' agenda. Is this of interest to you because you yourself are thinking about carrying out such studies?
As always, I'm going to keep some of my cards close to my chest. But at the moment, I haven't embarked on a pure microbiome study, partly for these reasons. It was more of interest for me about the multi-omic integration and actually, you know, thinking about other techniques like spatial transcriptomics, that is an even harder level to truly integrate the data. So I was really interested in this sort of last step, and they've done a specific technique called lasso regression. And what that meant and how it came out and how the conclusions were drawn. So I was interested in more in it from a pure technical point or kind of statistical analytical perspective rather than the exact details. And then as a kind of word of warning to myself over don't try and jump in and do something because it'll be quick and easy, because it will always be slow and difficult.
Well, I do want to point out to the folks at home, you would probably be well advised to attack this paper with your pocket microbiologist and your pocket statistician in attendance, because the paper takes as a given that you have some familiarity with both microbiologic detail and statistical detail that, to me at least, were the equivalent of ancient Greek verb conjugations. I can't tell you how often I toggled back and forth to Wikipedia to find out what in the world they were talking about. But I suppose it was all rewarding, if in nothing else, in terms of building character. Jake, we weren't able to use that cookshop metaphor. We weren't able to get you to reveal your secret sauce, at least as far as your own research has continued. And so we probably should move on to a different metaphor, that of your favorite actress and mine, Betty Davis, in All About Eve. Fasten your seatbelts. This was certainly a bumpy flight.
Thanks very much, Alex. See you soon.
Bye-bye now.